Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tour.com podcast. My name is Justin Landon, and I'm still your host. We are into episode 40-something. I can't count very high, but I'm joined by two writers with books coming out in the very near future. The first is Ferret Steinmetz. He's the author of the upcoming novel Flex from Angry Robot Books. He's also a Nebula-nominated short fiction writer with a great deal of short fiction credits, and he's a graduate of Clarion. Welcome, Ferret.
Hey, what up?
The other person on the show tonight is Monica Byrne, a writer and playwright based in Durham, North Carolina. She has a pilot's license and a degree from MIT. Her debut novel, The Girl on the Road, has been critically acclaimed. Welcome, Monica.
Thank you so much.
You're the first graduate from MIT to be on the show.
Oh, really? Wow. Well, that's a distinct honor, actually.
I mean, we have some other academically, you know, we had like Max Gladstone went to like, I don't know, Yale or something. So we have like smart people, but MIT,
whatever,
it's the first for MIT.
Yeah, good.
But you left out the most important part of her class thing, because she's also Clarion, and she's my Clarion.
That's right. You both went to Clarion in 2008.
Yep. Yes, which was a banner crazy year, because there was just a record number of applicants, apparently, and so there was quite a group there.
So tell me about it. Tell me about Clarion 2008.
Oh my God. How do we talk about it? This is like talking about fraternity days or like, you know, what you did, what the group did. And I'm afraid that it's not interesting to anybody else, but it's like a family or like a cult that you belong to. And you are, when you get to Clarion, sort of told you will know these people for years and years, and your careers will develop in parallel with each other. And, you also can't talk about what happens in the workshop. Like you're told that pretty explicitly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the weird thing about it is that, I mean, basically I talked to Tobias Bekel about Clarion before I went there. And he said that, you know, if you go to Clarion, it's 6 weeks and it speeds your career up by about 4 years, which seems about accurate. But the thing about it is that he says, once you come out of it, like there's going to be this crazy thing where you're going to be seeing all of your friends getting sales and you're getting sales. And you've got like this, you know, thug mob with you moving up through the ranks. And, you know, Monica is the thuggiest of my thug mob, I should think. But, you know, I mean, I'm just really proud to like see, you know, pretty much all of my Clarion people doing a whole bunch of sales and, you know, working on the fiction and getting great.
Yeah. I think everyone who wants to is doing really well. And like, you know, I think all of us are thugs, if we're using that word.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like everybody who's really, you know, trying hard to be their fiction is doing really well at it. And everybody who's taken a break, because frankly, Clarion is freaking intense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, afterwards, most people just needed to take a couple months off because they stuffed so much knowledge into your brain that, I mean, frankly, there's a lot of people I know who go into Clarion and the lesson they learn is they don't want to go through the stress of being a writer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a great thing to learn in 6 weeks, because otherwise you can waste years before you finally figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to love it enough. You have to love it enough to put up with the bullshit. There is bullshit inherent in any profession. And it's just like you find out very quickly whether you love writing enough and whether writing is enough of a desire and a compulsion to override the inherent difficulties. And there are quite a few in writing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you say it's a love of writing, and I agree with you on that, but it's kind of like a love of writing and a willingness to tolerate a lot of personal despair, a lot of failure, a lot of soul searching, and God, the rejections and bad reviews, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, and you and I think, have different approaches to writing, and I think we've talked about that before.
Oh, yeah, we totally have, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, Clarion was... We both had despairing experiences at Clarion and sort of came away with different lessons from the episodes of despair. But I'm being super vague because we're not necessarily supposed to talk about Clarion, and I don't want to tell Ferret's stories for him.
You can tell my stories for him. I want to hear my stories through you, because that's like the best kind of gossip you can get.
What? Secondhand?
It's like, well, you never hear what people are saying about you behind your back. To hear it on like a nationwide podcast, that's gold.
No, you have written about it very extensively on your own blog. Yes.
I have, yes.
Who was in your class? Do you guys remember?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just naming all like other 16 of them without leaving anybody off is just going to be a dick move.
Just give me like the most famous one.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
That's me.
Yeah, that's Ferret. That's Ferret.
Yeah. No, if we're going by the people who have kept writing, who you probably know if you follow science fiction, Cat Howard was in our class. Kefi Carey was in our class. Paul Berger, who just had a story published in FNSF, and he's brilliant at that. I'm probably forgetting other people because I'm stupid right now.
Yes, E.J. Fisher and Megan Kirishiga. And mm-hmm.
Emily Jang.
Emily Jang, yes. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, they're all definite presences in the field.
I also really enjoy, what are you, like a crew of thugs? Like, what's that about, Ferret? Come on.
Well, sure. I mean, the thing is, it's really weird because I have major social anxiety disorder. And, you know, I do blog about this, so I'm not really revealing anything. But, like, before I go to a convention, I usually have a meltdown because I'm like, you know, oh, my God, what if people hate me or something like that? And the weird thing about Clarion is that if I know there is somebody that I have been in my 2008 class at that convention, I know they've got my back and I can feel completely comfortable about going to that convention.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And that's true even if I never see them during the convention, which has actually happened. So
yes, it's like another member of the family is there. And on the contrary, I have never been to a convention and people are shocked when they hear that. And there's a whole mess of reasons why, but I'm sort of waiting to figure out which convention I'm going to break my convention cherry at.
The other 17 of us showed up.
Where?
Real Fancy.
Oh, okay. Shit.
You were the only absentee there, and we
Oh, God.
Damn.
Ouch.
I heard they actually excommunicated you there.
He just sat around smoking clove cigarettes in the back going, fucking Monica. You know.
Wait, is that the time that you took pictures with Neil in the bathroom?
No, that's another one. I wasn't there.
Okay.
Is that like Neil, like the Neil, or just a different?
The Neil Gaiman, yeah. That's why our class was so huge, because Neil Gaiman was one of the teachers then.
Yes. And so everybody applied for that year specifically. And there was a huge bunch of applicants who never even would have heard of Clarion otherwise, because they're Neil Gaiman fans and the Venn diagrams don't necessarily match up. There's just, he has his own whole following. So the class was really sort of diverse as well.
Interesting. Have you all heard about this sort of Clarion effect?
Define how Clarion effect.
the Clarion process, which I won't ask you to get into because I understand that it's, you know, what happens at Clarion stays at Clarion. But there's this sort of notion out there that the short fiction market in particular has been a little distorted by the Clarion effect, which is we're getting a lot of writers that have graduated from Clarion that are publishing short fiction, but we're seeing a lot of like very similar stories that are created through a very similar process that has been dubbed the Clarion process or the Clarion effect. Have you heard of this? Do you think it has merit?
I haven't heard of it, so I can't, and I can't comment. Like, I don't know. I can just say that the stories that I wrote, I've had three short stories published and they were all like in 2009, 2010. And then I just stopped submitting, but I definitely didn't notice too much of an advantage in terms of, things getting published. I did notice that people's ears perked up when they heard I went to Clarion, but you're talking about a different kind of bias, where a similar kind of story is being created and is showing up. And I don't feel like I know enough to comment on that. Ferret, what do you think?
Well, I don't know anything about it either, but I feel entirely justified in commenting on it.
You're a man after my own heart, brother.
Yeah, I'll just bluster on. That's male privilege right there. I can talk crap about anything.
Ouch. Nope.
But I do see some of that because I've noticed that it's not all Clarion people, but there are certain groups of each Clarion class who publish and they're very similar in style. And because I'm paying attention, I notice what years people have graduated. And the interesting thing is, I don't think it's necessarily a Clarion effect, but I think it's that, you know, certain students tend to hang together. It's like certain writers hang together because they have similar writing styles. And so when you get three or four of them at a class together and they begin supporting each other, then they start turning out fiction that is kind of like each other because they're all sort of aspiring to tell the same kinds of stories. And so you get a certain similarity, which I don't think is a result of Clarion, just as a result of certain people clustering together and having a Clarion label wrapped around them, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, like I wonder whether that would just happen anywhere, that people of like minds would find each other. It's just that Clarion is the most visible of the ways in which new writers find each other, maybe? Something like yeah. that.
And well, no, because if you look at it on Twitter, I mean, like, for example, Kat Howard, she applied to Clarion because she was a big admirer of Neil Gaiman. Fun fact, the only two stories she'd written were her her entry stories, her test stories to see if she could get into Clarion.
Uh-huh. Me too, actually, by the way.
I hate you!
Okay, go
people,
ahead.
People with your talent, anyways. But, I mean, you know, yeah. But I noticed that, you know, like, Kat and, I'm going to mispronounce her name, Maria Headley, Maria Devana Headley, and Neil tend to, like, you know, exchange talks a lot and, you know, exchange compliments a lot because they're all writing in the same kind of field. And they weren't in the same Clarion class, but they're all writing and blurbing each other's books because they're all very similar to each other in tone and style. You know, and that's not necessarily a bad thing because, you know, I certainly hang with my own writers who I think are similar to me in style. If you're going to get a critique, you want it to be from somebody who gets you thoroughly, and who better than from somebody who wrote a book that you really admire.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you want an ideal reader for you is someone who deeply empathizes, deeply sympathizes with what you are trying to do. And that's not every reader.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I love you, I love your writing, but you did not come to me to like create your novel because you know, fundamentally, I'm telling a different kind of story than you are.
Right, you know? Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And I suppose Clarion is just accelerating the publication schedules for these people because they're... It's a crucible, right? Like they're getting dumped into this. And if they come out on the other side, they're going to start putting things out more regularly, theoretically.
Yeah.
So we're seeing clusters. So we're seeing like story clusters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it is a filter. It is an initial filter. And actually Nick Mamatas just tweeted about this the other day about how like he would privilege Clarion stories above other stories and then notice that there is actually no difference from the slush. So like it doesn't just empirically, some people notice no difference at all from general slush. So, you know, that's fine.
Nick's so kind-hearted.
I really like him. I really like him.
Well, I have an inherent love for anybody who never blows smoke up anybody's ass, which clearly Nick doesn't know how to blow smoke.
Or if he does, it's brilliant satire.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I really appreciate just how biting the satire is. Yeah.
I feel like if he's somebody who gives you a compliment about your work, like you could definitely be like, yeah, that was a real compliment.
Oh, yeah, <You know>? Totally. And likewise, whenever I go out on a limb or feel like I'm putting myself at risk in the public sphere, I'm like, will Nick snark about this? Or like, yeah. It has to pass a test, like, would Nick snark? So WNS, like, will it pass that test? And, you know, I can't let my life rule that. I need to sit down and have pizza with him someday. But like he came to my play in Berkeley, which was fantastic, and that's the only time I've met him, and he was a super sweet, nice guy. So yeah.
Monica, it's interesting you mentioned that you've never been to a convention, and the impetus for this show started at a bar in Detroit during Confusion, a convention up there.
Uh-huh.
Which, by the way, I would highly recommend. Is
that's like my home con. Like I will, you know, many people will welcome you there, but I'll be at the door. So you know.
Oh,
mostly because it's like 90% writer, like professional writer.
It's like a condensed world fantasy, actually, you know, yeah. Not quite as swinging, but.
Ferret had heard that I have kind of a wacky definition of urban fantasy, which is basically condensed that the story must contain must be first person, must have snarky narrator, must have what Tansy Rayner Roberts calls angry trousers. And basically has to be a modern setting with some sort of magic. That is basically my definition of urban fantasy. If it doesn't have one of those things, it can't be urban fantasy.
Uh-huh.
And Ferret and I had a little back and forth about this, because his book has been called urban fantasy.
Yes.
Monica, your book has not really been marketed in any sort of particular genre. I guess my first question to both of you is, like, do you think you're writing urban fantasy?
See, here's
that's my answer.
The thing. I mean, there are, so I as a diversion, but it will come back to the point. So I'm also a playwright, and I am asked questions about the field, like, oh, so you're familiar with Brecht, or, you know, this play from the 60s that was really instrumental, assuming that I have a very in-depth knowledge of aspects of the field that I don't. Like, in both fiction and in playwriting, there are just so many lacunae in my knowledge. And so urban fantasy is like, I just think of Charles de Lint. I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind. But I, if I were to classify my own fiction, it would be literary fiction that happens to be set in the future and also has surrealist and magical elements. And like, it just doesn't, you know, the classification question is, I hate it. I'm sorry. But sorry. Yeah.
But you totally should, because it screws you in a way.
It does, because if I choose one, that means I've pigeonholed into one and closed off all the others. And there is a risk in saying it is no genre, or it will defile genres, because marketing is a real thing. Marketing depends on genre. Like, if you like this, you will like this. And the only way I feel like I can classify my novel is not classifiable, which is super snooty. But like, but that's also kind of how I feel. I mean, I don't feel like it's urban fantasy. I feel like I think about The Onion Girl. I think that's the name of the book when I think of urban fantasy.
So what about you, Ferret?
The thing about it is that I actually have no clue what I'm writing until I'm done with it. And even then, I'm not really sure what I've written. Because I'm a severe gardener. Like, I just come up with a sentence and I just follow it to the end of the book, and I have no idea what the hell is going on until I get done. And the interesting thing is, because my background is that I worked for Borders and Walden Books at their headquarters for about 6 years. I was one of the book buyers there. I was not the science fiction book buyer, but we went out to lunch on a regular basis, because if you want all the free books in the world, you go out to lunch with the science fiction book buyer. And so I know a lot about how those things get marketed. And when I write my book, like, for example, my book Flex, in traditional ways, it's not an urban fantasy, because what I said to you in confusion is what I think of urban fantasy. I'm thinking like, you know, Jim Butcher, and I'm thinking of Laurel Hamilton. I'm thinking of Sookie Stackhouse, maybe, depending on how you're looking at it, just those sort of very mainstream pulpy stuff that gets out there. And when I'm thinking of that, and I'm thinking of what I did, I think urban fantasy is the land of really kind of subtly bullshit world building.
Oh!
You know, and I'm saying this because my novel is subtly bullshit too, because let me give you an example of exactly how I'm talking so I don't trash talk anybody else. But in Flex, you have a magic system that's based on obsession. And if you are a crazy cat lady, like, at some point, your obsession for cats wears a hole in the laws of physics and you become a philomancer. And at that point, you start doing like crazy cat magic, except you're completely insane. So realistically, you're not going to take over the world. You're just going to make a pocket dimension for your cats.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
It's a ridiculous pitch. It really is.
That's, like, you know, so cool.
My lead character is a bureaucromancer. He believes in the power of paperwork. There's a video game mancer. There's crazy mancers in here. The point is, here's where the bullshit comes in. Despite all of this has happened, and it is established explicitly at one point in the book that there were paleomancers and pyromancers back in caveman days. Despite all of that, we go up to today and everything is exactly the same, including the video games that came out in which year. Everything is exactly the same in history right up until a certain point, because if you want to have what I would consider to be a lot of urban fantasy, you don't want to put too much weight on the reader to have them go, wait a minute, what's this world here? I don't understand. These people are talking a foreign language. I don't understand what this country is. Somehow, with all of this divergence, we still have America and Europe, and the Vietnam War ended in the same year. And you'll see that in a lot of other urban fantasy books, where basically what happens is you have these tremendously strange and mystical happenings in the background, yet everything's the same up until about the week before the book starts, so nobody has to worry about finding some sort of different branding that they have to associate with, if that makes any sense.
It does, although I love the trope in urban fantasy where it's like magic was just discovered last week, which is clearly how you get around this whole problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way. I mean, I think Mike Cole does a good job with that. It's like, oh, magic just came in. Great. You know, my book has a lot of overhead because this magic system is very complicated. It doesn't have a snarky first-person narrator. It has a snarky sidekick, but that's very different. And yet everybody seems to think that it's urban fantasy, and the preliminary reviews coming in are going, yeah, this is urban fantasy. Huh. And I'm just sort of shrugging, going, I guess.
Yeah.
We get into this weird scenario where we have milieus that we use to do sort of do genre classification or tone. Mm-hmm. And then we have like marketing categories, which are like very different things.
Yeah.
And like to me, urban fantasy has become a marketing category, which is why Jim Butcher, right, is like everybody wants to write Jim Butcher. They want to write Dresden Files. They want to sell Jim Butcher. They want to sell Dresden Files. It's a New York Times bestseller. It hit number one. Like it's, you know, it makes people aroused when it walks into the room. But
wow. That's how I feel about books. I don't know about you.
Right. All right. You know, all right.
I know, Monica, I've read your books. There's a lot of sex going on in there. So
I know. Can Justin promise? Let's bring that up later. Yes.
Yeah, we'll get to the sex in your books.
Okay, good.
Oh, my God.
But this would give further evidence.
She taught me new words for the vagina I never knew before.
Okay, Yoni! Yeah, Yoni! Okay.
You didn't know that one?
No, I didn't know that one. I'm sitting there going, is this some sort of Doom thing where I have to look this up? And I'm like, wait a minute, context, shit. You know, and it's, yeah.
Yep.
Do I italicize the word so we know that it's different?
Hell no. And that is actually a very important stylistic choice that I made. I didn't want to otherize the word, actually. And my editor and I had a back and forth about this. I felt very strongly I wanted all words to not be italicized. And that also reflects the polyglot of the future, where all languages are kind of crossbreeding. And yeah, and that's, you know. So, yeah.
I approve of this.
Thank you.
Jim Butcher makes people aroused, right? And so we call that urban fantasy. And so when we talk about urban fantasy from a marketing category, that's what we're talking about. But then you get these other people that talk about it as sort of like, well, if it's in a modern setting and there's magic, like, boom, urban fantasy. And this is like very obnoxious to me because it conflates what is a marketing category, which I think everybody here recognizes as valuable and important because that's how we sell books. But as an actual sort of creative endeavor, like it's sort of damaging.
Yeah.
Because it forces us into boxes.
Well, can I give an example of how this, I think, subtly screws or boosts an author, depending on how it works? Because you've had Robert Bennett on your show, and I think he's brilliant. And his book, American Elsewhere, literally brought me back from a heart attack, which is the best review I could possibly give to a book. Mm-hmm. The short version is I had triple bypass surgery. I'm hopped up on drugs. My concentration was jangled. I thought I could never read a book again. And I read American Elsewhere, and I just read through like 700 pages in a day. And I'm like, oh, I've got my reading back.
Wow.
And I thought that was a brilliant book. And yet it didn't seem to get the buzz that I thought it should because I would try to describe the book, and I like make words for a living. I'm sitting here going, well, it's got like a kind of 1950s vibe. It's got like Cthulhu monsters. It's kind of like weird Wrinkle in Time fanfic. I don't know. It's cool. Just buy it.
Yeah.
And then he came out with City of Stairs, and that one caught fire. And I think that's because people said, what is that? Oh, that's an epic fantasy, like with a twist. And suddenly that one took off. And I don't think there's much of a difference in quality between American Elsewhere and City of Stairs. But I think in terms of your Joe person on the street being able to talk this book up to somebody else in a way that sounds immediately interesting, putting in the bucket of epic fantasy makes it a lot better for word of mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. And we are conditioned to respond that way too. So a story from Clarion actually is that I had the idea for The Girl in the Road for many years before I started writing it and had it while I was at Clarion. And I forget who came from one of the big publishing houses, maybe Tor, and we all practiced giving pitches. Do you remember this, Ferret?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. And I gave my pitch, which was, it's about a woman who walks across the Pacific Ocean at that time, a woman who walks across the Pacific Ocean by herself. And I tried to condense the pitch as much as I could. And she was just so down on it. She was just like, yeah, well, but what is it? You know, it was just like, it was a really dispiriting reception. And, you know, like my book can't be, it can't be condensed into a pitch. Like, I guess if I tried to, it would be like, what if Norman Rush wrote science fiction? Like, that's the closest I can come. And like, I don't know how much that works, but like, it's just so frustrating. It's frustrating to me. And I don't know what effect it would have if it were really easy or if there was a different marketing strategy, or if this, there was another way to describe the girl in the road. Yeah. I mean, how are you marketing Flex? Like, what is your strategy behind it?
Well, you see, that's the thing. It actually kind of worries me because, like I said, I don't think it's urban fantasy. It's certainly urban fantasy flavored, but that's the way it's getting sold. You know, it's like, oh, yeah. Jim Butcher meets Breaking Bad. And it is, you know, that's the way, that's literally what it says on the Angry Robot website. So I cringed when you said that. I mean, like, literally for me, I am actually worried that, you know, I have this book and I'm worried people are going to be disappointed when they get it. Not because it's a bad book, but because it didn't fit the box that they thought it came in.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm getting a lot of reader reactions being like, this isn't science fiction. This was marketed the wrong way. I was led to believe, like, they're betrayed or something.
Wait, it's not science fiction?
Yeah,
your book is science fiction. Anybody who says it's not science fiction, you send them to my door, I will send them spanking.
Yeah, I'm baffled by that particular, like, I'm baffled by it.
Well, it's not obvious science fiction. Basically, what you're doing in it is you're doing a lot of subtle cultural stuff. And if you're not paying attention, aside from like the one big specific element of the road that she walks across the ocean on, you could just take it as, you know, kind of a crazy normal novel with, if you don't know foreign culture too well, it all just looks foreign-y to you.
Yeah. And that's another thing I felt very strongly about not handholding. Like, I actually love novels where I have to figure things out and or learn things, basically. Norman Rush, again, I mentioned him, but, you know, I read his books and I have to look up 2-3 pages every word, or I'm sorry, look up 2 or 3 words every page that I have never seen before, words I'm sure I have never seen before in my life. And I love that. And so, you know, but that's not everybody's ideal reading experience. And I get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because my day job, I sell Magic cards, which is Magic the Gathering. It's a collectible card game. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they talked about was the star rating, where they give you like a Goodreads, you know, rating for each card from 1 to 5. Mm-hmm. And they said what they found out was that a lot of the cards that were like 3, 3.5 stars were actually really good cards, except if you averaged it out, it didn't know.
Yeah.
Because if you look at most cards, it's like 3, yeah, that's good. Bam, put that out there. But if you look at certain cards where it's like, half the people have give it a 1-star rating because they friggin' hate it, and the other half give it a 5-star rating because it's the best thing ever.
Yeah, that is the reaction to my novel in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. When I'm coming out with, like, I mean, obviously, I've got crazy catmancers. I've got video game people. I've got alt-sex, pudgy women who are still attractive and have their own agenda, hopefully, going through this stuff. And I know that there are going to be some people who pick this up and go, this is my thing. But for every one of those people, some people are going to pick it up and just reject it out of hand the way that they did your book. Because I think your goal as a writer is to write something that strikes true to somebody's heart that they call the sacred text.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. You know, if you can get that, then you've got a fan for life and that'll get you a career. And if you write a bunch of 3-star books that are genuine 3 stars, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Because they sort of please everyone and people don't have strong emotional reactions to them. I mean, I love anyone having a strong emotional reaction to my book, no matter in what direction it is, because it means I'm doing it right as a writer, that I am striking something in them, no matter what that feeling is. And I feel like that's my job. It does mean that, you know, I have 3.5-star ratings on everything. And that's really frustrating because people don't know the law of averages and they click on that and they think it's a mediocre book, not that like, people have told me this is the book I've been waiting for all my life, you know? And so, yeah, but that's the nature of the beast. That's part of the territory.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we don't talk about a whole lot though, but I think you're both saying is that expectations are an enormous part of whether or not somebody's going to enjoy something or not. It's like going into a text with a certain set of expectations. Because so much of what we read is based on how we feel before we read it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I sit down and I say, like, I really want to read a space opera. Or I really want to read, you know, some postmodern thing because I'm in a thinky mood or, like, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, you have to be in the right mood for the right book. And if I sit down to Monica's Girl in the Road and I'm saying, like, I really want to – I can't wait to read a science fictional romp.
Oh, God.
That's not what I'm going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a science fictional romp of a kind. We will say that. But it's not like a space opera, for example. It's not light, for sure.
No. And the thing is, I've actually had books ruined for me because of the wrong pitch. Infamously, Neil Gaiman's American Gods. I was like 300-400 pages into it waiting for stuff to happen because my friend Dimitri had pitched the book to me. He's like, oh man, it's like you have these gods and they're like superheroes and they're fighting and they're going at each other and they're bashing each other. It's great battles. And I got like 300 pages into it. I'm like, well, this seems like kind of a sad trip through middle America that's mournful and reflective, but I guess the battles will come in.
That's a horrible pitch.
It is a horrible pitch, but I didn't know that till the end. And I got to the last 20 pages. I'm like, I guess this isn't happening. It's not Neil's fault that I didn't like his book, and I hope to go back to it at some point and read it once I can get rid of Dimitri's horrible, horrible pitch. But, I mean, seriously, if somebody pitches you a book in the wrong way, which is why marketing is so important, and which is why Monica and I have this sort of vague worry that maybe marketing is mis-selling our book, because you can make a book bad just by having somebody have the wrong expectations when they open up chapter one.
Although, I will say this. I think the long game does matter more in these cases. So, for example, I don't trust pitches and I don't try to pitch things that I like. I just say to my friend, Skylar, for example, you need to read this book. And because we have a long history of trading like things that we know each other will like, she'll be like, okay, I will read this book. And I don't try to prepare them in any way. And I also don't like to be prepared or persuaded. I just take recommendations of things people send me and say, you must read this. Because the descriptions are always wrong. And also, maybe here's another super snotty thing to say. Really good art can't be described. It can't be. That sort of defeats the purpose of it. Like, the description of the art is the art. That was a very Borges thing to say. But like, you know, that's like, there is no description. Just read it.
But that's what genres do. They kind of take the air out of art in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I find sort of distressing about Twitter, even as it's empowering, because now that I'm on Twitter, I'm following so many good authors, and those authors are obviously recommending other books. Mm-hmm. But it also means that if there's a book that's coming out and it's got a lot of buzz about it, I know most of what category and genre it's supposed to be and like a rough idea of the plot before I even pick up the book on day one. Mm-hmm. Just by being tuned in. So, I mean, I'm with Monica. When I pick up a book, I don't want to know anything. And I find in the era of spoilers and book reviews and just, you know, people blabbing all the time, it's harder and harder to get that pristine, you know, here, take the book, unless it is a friend handing a book to you out of nowhere, which is like the best way of marketing your book.
Yeah.
You cannot plan on anyone doing that ever.
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Tell me,
I want to do this for my next novel because I've clearly screwed up.
Write a book that will make people want to recommend it to other people, like very passionately.
Why didn't I do that?
No,
you fool, Ferret. It's so easy.
I'm not saying about Flex one way or the other, Ferret.
I know.
By the way, send me a damn copy. Like, I didn't, I need, what?
Okay, I can send you a copy.
Good.
I agree with you perfect. I mean, but it's kind of like saying, you know, here's how you get to the Olympics. Just be a perfect athlete. Like that trick of marketability, like it's interesting because one of my best friends is Kat Valenti, and watching her come up through the ranks, and she's got a real fervent audience of people who love her books. Mm-hmm. And I have watched people who come up to me and practically grab me, you know, by the shirt and go, you know, Kat, can I touch you? And it's really, you know, it's really the sort of star thing. But when Kat writes a book, it appeals to a certain audience so much that they will go out and hand sell that book like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know some people have done that for Girl on the Road. I hope some people do that with Flex. But how you actually modulate that beyond writing a great book is really, really hard to figure out.
Yeah. And I'm mid-process. Like, full disclosure, I'm totally mid-process on this. I'm saying what I would like to be true and don't have data for in the long haul yet.
Well, so author Mike Cole has often told me that a great book will find its audience, right? Except, you know, Robert Jackson Bennett is a great example, Ferret. He's written he's published five novels. Mm-hmm. Mr. Shivers, The Company Man, The Troop, American Elsewhere and City of Stairs. And the only book of those four or those five that I believe really has found its audience is the first book, Mr. Shivers, which won a Shirley
Jackson. Was it Bram Stoker Award? Oh, no, it was Shirley Jackson.
It was a Shirley Jackson Award. And then his newest one, City of Stairs, and all these other books in between have, you know, sold from okay to awful. And maybe 20 years from now when Robert, you know, is a number one New York Times bestseller, those books will sell and will come back. But, you know, 6 years in, 7 years in, it doesn't seem that quality is finding its audience all on its own. You know what I mean? And so time will tell. And Elizabeth Baer is another great example of somebody who is immensely talented. I think her books are wonderful, but hasn't yet had that breakout, you know, moment where, and she's published 27 novels.
Yeah.
Just staggering for a woman her age. She's only been publishing for 10 years. But
holy
seriously? Oh my God, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, her first novel published in 2003, 2004, and she's published 27 novels since.
Okay, because I met her in like 2005, and she already had like five novels out, so I figured she'd been doing it forever.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. But you know, she's another one who's yet to find her audience despite writing. I mean, she's found her audience, but it hasn't found perhaps the large audience that it deserves despite being great. And this is,
but not every audience is going to be a large audience. I mean, like, you know, you can write a perfectly great thing, but I mean, I'm thinking of David Cronenberg's Crash, the movie, you know, which is going to appeal to people immensely who get turned on by being in automobile wrecks. But no matter how exquisite you make that experience, it's still going to be a probably pretty small audience, you know.
Yeah. Still going to be a niche film.
I hope.
Yeah, right.
If it turns out there's like some sort of film festival in a town with that, I'm not going anywhere near that town on the freeway. So, you know.
Earlier, Monica mentioned that her books have the sex in it.
Yeah. I think Ferret mentioned it and I confirmed it.
if we're gonna be pedantic. But Ferret, you've been pretty outspoken about very outspoken,
extremely outspoken
on your blog and elsewhere about alt sex and other matters like that.
I'm a polyamorous author. I'm into alt sex. I teach at kink conventions. I pretty much do the whole shebang. So
I was going to ease into that, but all right.
Yeah, no, I'll get it out.
Dive in.
You rip off that band-aid.
But as we talk about sort of like marketing and expectations and putting the things in your books that you want to put in. I mean, how did you want to put all that stuff in your book? Is it in your book? Is it not in your book? Like, how did you have that conversation with yourself as you wrote your debut novel?
Well, actually there's a character in it called Valentine, who is, basically stuff that I don't see in books a whole lot. Which is to say she's pudgy, which was a whole thing that I had to get in there. Because I'm attracted to larger women, and yet I don't ever see them portrayed as sexy, which is one thing which sounds kind of creepy when I'm saying it out loud right now. But there's not a whole lot of representation of, you know, quote unquote overweight women who get to be sexy and characters in their own right without having to slim down or learn a lesson by the end of the book or be the comic relief.
That's not creepy. That's awesome.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not creepy at all.
And Valentine is snarky. She's basically, if you like the voice here when I'm snarking off, that's Valentine throughout the entire friggin' book. If you don't, it's not her. Buy the book. It's awesome. But anyway, but you know, I made Valentine because she's unabashedly sexual. She's unashamed of wearing skimpy skirts for who she is. And she's unabashedly into all sex. You know, and basically she has some pretty sexual habits, which don't come up in the books because, unfortunately the book doesn't have many sex scenes because, the lead character, Paul, is very straight and has a stick up his ass and basically is a good guy, but he's not going to want to see any of that, so the readers don't see it.
You mean to tell me that a Bjork romancer isn't into crazy sex?
No. Which is why it's so fun to team him up with a crazy alt-kink video game mancer. But yeah, so there's a lot of that going on in there, which I just put in basically because I wanted to invert some tropes. The one thing that I have tried to do is if you look at it, actually you have the manic pixie dream girl, thing, you know, where somebody comes along and takes somebody out of their life and leaves them on grand adventures. And I've tried to invert it. So in fact, Paul is Valentine's manic pixie dream guy. Although because he's a bureaucromancer, he's not terribly manic or, you know, pixie, but he does in fact show her whole new ways of life. and I try to invert a lot of those tropes. So there's a lot of alt sex hinted at in my books, but it's not as explicit as Monica, which has a lot of very explicit and very hot sex scenes in there. So
there you go, Monica. He teed it up for you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Larian 2008, represent.
I know, right? Tentacles. Tentacles is a whole other, we just throw it out there. It's like our rallying call. But anyway, the sex scenes in The Girl in the Road, I've been asked this in interviews. I'm actually answering an interview question about it right now. And, you know, the question being like, how did you approach or how did you think about or conceive of Mina's the main character's sexuality? And were you worried that, for example, her being bisexual was, and portraying her as being very sexually aggressive was just fulfilling a stereotype, like that bisexual people are promiscuous or confused or emotionally damaged or something? And, you know, yeah, definitely. I was afraid of that. But I think in this case, Mina is an emotionally damaged person who also really happens to love sex, and that I trust my readers to understand that distinction. And also to portray that those people exist. Like, sex is actually, like, surprise, not all about shame. Like, who knew? Or not, just not bound to relationships or bound to senses of propriety or monogamy in the same way that is so universally portrayed. And I felt like that very much needed to be out there. And it's never an issue for Mina, like her hunger for sex or even her past. Like, she loses her virginity to someone who's twice her age, and she probably has mixed feelings about that. But like, I know people who have done that and, you know, been in those situations, and they have mixed feelings about it too, but it's not like the be all end all of their self-esteem. You know, it's just, I wanted to portray sexuality in a very naturalistic and healthy way. And I feel like I did that with Mina. Yeah.
Can I add something on that one? Having read your book?
Yeah.
The one thing I do want to say is the scene where the girl loses her virginity to a much older person. It's interesting because you just put that out there. Like, you're not really casting a moral judgment on it. You're basically saying it happened. And yet it's interesting because in the review, some of the reviews you pointed to, people very much bring their own opinions on what that means right there. And, you know, say, oh, you're condoning this. And you're like, no, this actually just happens to people. I'm just kind of putting this in the book, if I'm reading you correctly.
Totally. I mean, confusing. Oh, God, what's the phrase? Don't confuse reportage with advocacy. Mm-hmm. That is it. This is a thing that happens all the time. How you feel about it is what you are bringing to it. And that, you know, that goes for every moral situation in the whole book. I mean, I don't feel like I judge my characters necessarily. I do show that that their actions have consequences within the moral universe of the book. That I think is important, but I don't feel like I judge them, and I don't feel like it's my place to, and I don't feel like that's what a good novel does either. A good novel is a co-creation with the reader. And so those people who have really, really strong reactions to the sex scenes, to all kinds of things in the book, I'm like, awesome. You're co-creating this story with me. You brought a lot to it. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I feel like after that, I now think of genres like monogamy. Like,
awesome. Yeah, my book is polyamorous, and so is Barrett. We're swingers.
We're genre swingers.
We are genre swingers. That's it.
I feel like that metaphor could actually work. I think there's like an extended blog post in that meta comparison.
Go for it, Barrett. That's all you.
I'm staying away from that one for mysterious reasons.
So, Fair, your book is coming out in the first week of March, right?
Right, March 3rd, yeah.
Much delayed.
Yeah, I mean, basically Angry Robot almost shut down, and the release date has been juggled like 3 or 4 times. But fortunately, they feel confident enough in the book to basically say, hey, Angry Robot's back, and we've got Ferret Steinmetz, and let me tell you, that's no pressure at all.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? But that's also awesome that they are saying you're like that they are counting on your name as well. Like, because you're that well known. That's awesome.
I think they're counting on the book more than anything else. I'm hoping they're counting on the book because if they're counting on my name, I'm not that big yet.
But you're known.
I feel like the title, it flex. You know, mm-hmm. It's like Angry Robots posing down, they oiled up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, actually, in fact, there is a bodybuilder mancer in the book.
Awesome.
Nice.
Well, it's like C-3PO saying, if you don't need me for a while, I'll shut down. And then when he comes back, he'll be, you know, he's all oil bathed up and everything. So I guess that's what Angry Robot is, except it's more like docile robot.
I think you've just totally sexualized that scene for me.
Oh my god.
I'm not happy about it.
Sorry. Cosplay.
Yeah, you know, 3PO's actually going, hang on, I gotta get some lube. That he's a little disturbing.
Pretty much. It's like furries, but like metal-ies. Are there metal-ies?
I'm sure there are. I mean,
There must be.
The great thing about being in the kink community is you find people, I'm gonna say, pleasuring themselves to things you never believed would actually be pleasurable to. So, you know.
Yes. I believe that too.
Yeah. I'm not going to share because I like you people to sleep at night. So
I've been on the internet, so I believe pretty much anything. And Monica, your trade paperback is out next week?
Yes. February 17th. It comes out on Tuesday. Yes. So right. Oops. It comes out on February 17th. Yes.
And has your hardcover been out for a year?
It's been out since May 20th. Yeah. But it's a very different cover. And so people may feel like they're seeing it for the first time. It's a very, very different, sort of much, much more genre cover, actually. Very colorful and impassioned. Whereas the hardcover was sort of, very abstract and in another way. So, yeah.
So are you hopeful that with this one that perhaps more of the core genre audience will pick it up? Is that kind of the goal, you think?
Yes, I would say yes. I would love for my work to be more well known in the genre field, in the audience of this podcast. I mean, I feel like I'm in this community, but sort of also outside of it, like not nearly as in it as Ferret has been. And, you know, I haven't been to conventions, but like I do identify this community as my home or one of my homes. And so I would like my work to be known in the field.
All right. Well, we're going to make that happen.
Awesome.
because if I'm not mistaken, you were also on our sister podcast, Midnight in Karachi. And I think that comes out next week.
Yes, it does.
So you're going to be all over tour.com for like two straight weeks.
Work it, Monica. Work it.
Yeah. Woo.
All right. Awesome. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you both coming on the show.
Thank you.
So
thank you.
Everybody can check out Flex on March 3rd and Girl in the Road on February 17th. This has been Rocket Talk.